The heritage of religious art is a long and extensive one in all civilizations. Yet in the contemporary world, many would say that art and religion as cultural zones are at odds. On the surface, it too often appears that the institutions of art and religion are either uninterested in what the other has to offer or engaged in a contentious battle of ideologies. There is very little art patronage coming from the religious institutions for living artists, and though some artists continue to appropriate religious symbols in their work in an attempt to reconstruct or expand the meaning of these symbols, the work is directed to the art audience more than to the religious community. Appropriation of religious symbols is usually regarded by religious institutions as threatening and detrimental to the life of that symbol, and all too often, the artist's work is understood as being critical and opposed to religion rather than as a visual form attempting to provoke thoughtful critique and discussion, to renew meaning or to expand meaning. One of the most recent controversies focused on Chris Ofili's painting, The Holy Virgin Mary, in the exhibit Sensation at the Brooklyn Museum in the fall of 1999. The painting is an Africanized depiction of the Virgin Mary with her breast bare. Hanging from her breast is a large clump of elephant dung. A practicing Catholic, Ofili explained how his depiction of Mary is an attempt to explore his Nigerian heritage within the context of Western culture. Dung is a symbol of fertility in that culture. But the elephant dung sent up a red flag, and the media seized the opportunity to exploit the political agenda of New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, who sought to position himself as the defender of public morality and religious sensibility, threatening to revoke funding to the museum. Likewise, the late John Cardinal O'Connor opposed the work and declared that the entire exhibit showed disrespect for religion in general. However, if we listen to the artist, then Chris Ofili's work is an unorthodox but valid effort to expand the theology and cultural understanding of a powerful religious symbol such as the Virgin Mary. The controversy around Ofili's work immediately reminds us of the even more damaging battle around Andres Serrano's Piss Christ in 1988 when he presented his photograph of a crucifix bathed in a rich, glowing yellow substance which turned out to be urine. The controversy centered on the issues of censorship and the scandal of public funding for art that denigrates religious symbols. Eleanor Hartney, whose particular area of research is the impact Catholicism has had on contemporary art, reminds us that Serrano's use of body fluids is in keeping with the tradition in Western religious art and literature, which presents the blood of Christ, the milk of the Virgin, and even somewhat more obscurely, the semen of God as the elements through which the miracle of Christ's incarnation made human redemption possible. Sadly, the political effort to suppress his work and wound the National Endowment for the Arts overshadowed more thoughtful discussions of the work. Thus, most people failed to grasp the deeply religious dimension to Serrano's work, or that the artist was employing what Paul Tillich described in modern art as the purposeful disruptiveness, or that which breaks through the appearances of things to uncover depths of reality. All humans have sought to grasp meaning, the kind of meaning that religion and art are capable of defining. While it is the religious institution's role to maintain the meaning of its symbols, in doing so, it can fail to recognize the profundity of the artist's contribution. Then at the same time, those who write about art may not know enough about the history and practice of religion to adequately interpret the profoundly religious dimension to many contemporary artworks. Robert Gober's installation 2 years ago at the Geffen Contemporary in Los Angeles is one example of this. It was a multi-layered installation, pivoting on a larger-than-life statue of the Virgin Mary. Through her torso was a culvert pipe, suggesting the access through which the divine entered the world. Behind Mary, flowing water tumbled and cascaded down a staircase into a drain that flowed under the floor into a luminous underworld filled with plant and sea life. Over the water hung the dangling legs of a baby. You can barely see them down there. And these were held by a man. The secret world was a paradise inverted that could only be viewed through the open suitcases on either side, which are symbols of pilgrimage and passage, and through the grate at the feet of Mary, who Catholics claim as an access to the divine. The staircase provided a symbol of transcendence, the axis mundi, linking the upper region to the earthly realm of the museum to the underworld below. One was also reminded of water and how it is one of religion's powerful symbols of birth, death, and rejuvenation. Because Mary had a drainage pipe through her torso, there was the anticipated reaction of shock and outcry on the part of many. The Catholic League condemned the work. But more surprisingly, in the catalog essay, it was the culvert pipe that Paul Schimmel emphasized as a phallic symbol of penetration to lead into a very thoughtful discussion of sexuality and gender issues commonly seen in Gober's other work. What was lacking, though, in the catalog and in much of the other writings surrounding Gober's installation was an adequate interpretation of the richer religious dimension at the heart of this installation. For the past several years, I have been teaching a course on religion and contemporary art in the Department of Religious Studies and the College of Creative Studies with Richard Hecht. And in that course, we have sought to investigate the ways in which the sacred is pertinent to our discussion and understanding and interpretation of contemporary art. We argue that in contemporary art, we can identify a persistence of the sacred. In the various ways, many artists continue to investigate the larger underlying issues at the root of all religion. In the work, we take up the work of many contemporary artists, such as Bill Viola, whose work consistently deals with issues of life, death, and immortality. Nancy Holt, along with other land artists in the 70s who returned to the primordial spaces of the desert to create works outside of the art institution that bring to mind creation myths and the cosmic understanding of time. We talk about artists such as Marina Abramović, who undergo extreme bodily practices in order to transcend their earthly state and reach a higher state. Artists like Wolfgang Leib, the artist as contemplative mystic who methodically gathers bee pollen, a very painstaking and long process, so that he can then bring that into the gallery and dust the floor in these squares to reveal the mystical substance of the pollen. Another artist, Doris Saucedo, who gathers the private horrific stories of individuals in Latin America, then works to integrate and embed their individual memory into objects. She works their stories into the objects themselves so that they become materializations of collective memory. We talk about many other artists such as Anson Kiefer, Felix Gonzalez-Torres, Ana Mendieta, James Terrell, Anne Hamilton, all artists that emphasize the deeply religious dimension that persists in their work. The current exhibition, Faith, the Impact of Judeo-Christian Religion on Art at the Millennium at the Aldrich Museum of Contemporary Art in Ridgefield, Connecticut, gathers together 36 artists from 6 different countries whose work centers around issues pertinent to Judaism and Christianity. The director of the museum, Harry Philbrick, acknowledges that in America, religion becomes almost a curatorial untouchable, with the inherent connection between art and religion unmentioned in the art world today. In the exhibit are artists that you would expect, such as Andre Serrano, Reverend Ethan Akers, Helene Elon, who explores the issues of power within a religious context, specifically the power of men over women within the Jewish Orthodox faith. There are artists who seek to explain the mystery of existence, such as James Plensa, and this interactive work, Born Die, in which he creates a piece in which the viewer is invited to strike the gong and participate in an understanding of their own mortality. This is a work by Osvaldo Romero, who reconstructs the floor plans of various sacred spaces from other locations in the globe. And these are made by placing the logs around. And at the end of the exhibit, the public is invited to take the logs home and burn them in this ritual that extends beyond the space. There's the work of Diane Samuels in her letter liturgy, which embroiders the words from the well-known Hasidic tale, "Dear God, I do not know how to pray, but I can recite the alphabet. Please accept my letters and form them into prayers." Or in one of my own contributions included in the exhibition is Isaiah Rose, which mediates upon the words of the prophet by integrating them onto the surface of a silk rose that hangs suspended from the wall. Most importantly, I think, about this exhibit is that it rises above the level of scandal to seriously address the issue of religion as one of the subjects vital in art today. And that will lead me into a discussion of my own work. In my work, religion is the vehicle through which I speak. And my work is firmly rooted in the book. First, there is the primary book of Western culture, the Bible, which I alter and I transform to present the sacred word as sacred object and to suggest that its authority can be reinvested and restructured. Then there is the book as a cultural object, a symbolic form which conjoins the private and the public, a space for narratives, the telling and retelling of events and lives that inspire. In my work, I constantly return to this form of the book, either enshrining it or extending it into space. Both I see as locations of individual memory woven into collective memory. And I've categorized the work I'm going to show you tonight in three areas: the Bible, or the book, specifically the memory spaces, and then materialized memory, or these objects that I create that come from the inspiration from the narratives and the stories of individuals. I have to start, though, with this piece called Emily's Pillow, which I created in 1994. When I was doing research on the poet Emily Dickinson, I learned how the poet was very reticent about having her photo taken. In fact, there are only two known photos of her in existence. And in 1862, when her mentor Thomas Wentworth Higginson wrote requesting a picture, she responded with a written description of how she looked. And I found a photo of this, a photo reproduction of the letter, so I could actually see her handwriting. It read, "Could you believe me without? I had no portrait now, but am small like the wren, and my hair is bold like the chestnut burr, and my eyes like the sherry in the glass that the guest leaves. Would this do just as well?" With that, I became very fascinated with her handwriting, and I began searching for more reproductions of it, because I saw a power in her handwriting like that of the relic. These were marks left behind by her. So I wanted to use this to make a visual form, and I enlarged it and I embroidered it onto the surface of a pillowcase. And I figured this would be a place where the poet might rest her head, and I could imagine her sleeping each night in a sea of words. But when it came time to stuff the pillowcase, I needed something other than an ordinary pillow. The notion came to me to shred a Bible and stuff the pillow with a Bible. So Emily's Pillow was one of many works that were thematically linked to Emily Dickinson, but they also set me on this direction with the Bible. The second piece is Spherical Bible, which I created in 1995. And I began this as a visual form that would represent the way Emily Dickinson wrestled with her Calvinist culture throughout her whole life. I wanted to create a domestic form that would represent this woman, but also would deal with the scripture. So I took the Bible basically and cut it apart line by line, creating these switchbacks so you could pull the text out in one long continuous line, and I began rolling this into a ball. But I wanted something that looked like a domestic ball of yarn, but I also thought it was very imperative that the intellectual order be maintained in the Bible. Therefore, the balls are books grouped according to the traditional Christian division of the Pentateuch, the historical books, the wisdom books, the prophets, and the New Testament. The balls are encased in this somber black box, and in the end, after I finished this piece, I realized that I had created this essence of words that it was as if I had squeezed the Bible into these balls that could only be reverenced by touch, by turning and deciphering the words and the line fragments. And I realized that I had created a tactile read of the Bible. So whether Emily Dickinson served as my muse, or I would prefer to think of her as my saint, the spherical Bible became the first in a series of altered Bibles in which I transformed sacred word into sacred object, and I'll show you many of those. Again, what Tillich describes as that purposeful disruptedness necessary to break through the appearance of things to uncover depths of reality. And the Bibles open the way, I think, for a sensitive viewer to see and understand the central mystery of the divine in matter. Sophia Logos was created in 95. I think that this Bible especially entices human touch and offers perhaps an even more tactile read than the previous one. The pages are bound at the spine. And then have been cut apart line by line so that they seem to spill out beyond the confines of the cover. The arrangement is tangled and fragmented so that one can grasp meaning only in partial reads. From this chaos, which eradicates the accepted patriarchal order of the Bible, I saw a new order emerge, which inspired the title, Sophia Logos, Uniting the Female Personification of God, Sophia, wisdom, with the male personification, Logos, word. This piece in the foreground is Torah Bale. I shredded the Hebrew Bible and I pressed it into a cluster form that rests on the floor. The presentation was one that suggested vulnerability of the sacred words that can be fragmented, misinterpreted, scattered by individuals and institutions or powers that dominate to seek to dominate the meaning. Memory text takes the Bible in which I pulped it in a blender and then I squeezed it into these balls. The piece is also shown on the floor, emphasizing the vulnerability. In prophets, I've taken the words of the male prophets and I've connected them into a long continuous line that is twisted and twined into this ropey vine-like structure that again eradicates the readability, as does Bible Sphere. This one I included the cover as well, where I rolled the entire Bible, and the twined Bible. So these again eradicate the readability. Blossoming is one that emphasizes the tradition of the seductive beauty of the sacred object, where the Psalms have been cut away and formed into this cluster of roses that decorate the cut Bible, drawing the viewer away again from a logical read of the text. But I wanted to create something that one could experience all at once, to visually take the whole thing in as this entity, as opposed to logically reading. So there's an entirety I was going after, and I just wanted to create something really beautiful as well in this piece. Here's a close-up of the tiny roses that are torn and formed from the Psalms. So I admit that there is a tension that exists in these words, works, because they are reverent, at the same time they are very subversive. I As I create the altered Bibles, I soon begin to understand the feminist implications of what I was doing, because in these forms, the Bible on which the patriarchal religious system perpetuates itself is symbolically subverted. Therefore, in all of the Bible works, interpretation becomes a very central issue. These forms abstract the arrangement of words in a logical order so that the book can no longer be read literally. My understanding of these sculpted Bibles is drawn from the Jewish tradition's long fascination and use of Midrash. Midrash is the interpretive mode that exposes new meanings, new possibilities of understanding, divine revelation, in the verses, the phrases, the words, groups of letters, or even in a single letter itself. Meaning is continually uncovered through Midrash. Thus, the meaning of Scripture can never be limited to a single meaning. The altered Bibles might be seen as a materialized or concrete visual Midrash. They serve as visual symbols against fundamentalized meanings that are so much a part of our times. There is also a very strong ritual dimension to the altered Bibles. This piece is Finger Prayers, created in 1994, and this was my first attempt to genuinely integrate religious ritual with art process. In the work, I set up a situation where I meditated on the individual lines of the Psalms, which are central to the contemplative religious lives of Jews and Christians. And my intent really was to make a work that was a ritual prayer. In Pearl Bible from 1996, again, I emphasize the ritual aspect of the process. I cut apart the Bible line by line, and then I rolled each line into these tiny little pearl-sized balls. And for much of the process, I was joined by women friends. I had to get the piece finished for a show, and so I asked my friends if they would join me and help me roll this Bible. Linda's here. She helped me do it. And what happened is we sat around the table together and we pearled this Bible, and it became a very meaningful collective religious experience for me. It was like a ritual, and many people stopped and read the lines, or we talked about our own religious practices or our childhood growing up and that sort of thing. So it was a really meaningful part of the piece. Imprint is another work that calls for the viewer to activate the work in a privatized ritual way by stepping forward and placing their fingertips directly into the pages of the sacred text, into the wounds that are left by my imprint. This piece actually hangs extended out from the wall, so the viewer would walk up to it and place their fingers into the wounds. Opera Opum was created in 1994. This is a work in which I wanted to push beyond the surface of things into the mystical realm. I turned two Bibles over to the bees by placing them inside of a beehive, and what resulted was a very fascinating work within the tradition of the icon, in that the work seems to embody a living presence or become a window into eternity or the mystical realm. I had put the book into the hive expecting the bees to just, deposit some honeycomb right on top of the pages, but instead the book confused them, and, or maybe it didn't, but they, because what they did was better than my idea, but they chewed down through the pages and revealed other lines to create new reads. And I remember one of my peers in graduate school saying to me how she really saw the idea that the matriarchal system of the bees had overlaid the honeycomb onto the patriarchal book. And from there, I began exploring the property of honey, which has a long symbolic history. These are book-like. Anything that's a container to me is book-like. And these are book-like in that they hold the symbolic objects in this sacred property of honey, such as, see, I have bones on the left, a candle, roses, milk and honey in the center, the bird wing, thorns, and then finally an apple on the far right. And these are backlit and illuminated. This piece is Trinity, and it combines three jars with matter, symbolizing God as creator, as human, and as spirit. I haven't decided which, though, is which. I like to leave that mystery. Another piece I did, and this is really the best slide I've been able to take. It's the shroud of Jesus' words. It's more notions about materialization and the incarnation. I had a Protestant Bible that had the red text where Jesus' words were spoken and recorded. And so I cut out all of these lines that are attributed to Jesus, and I rolled these into these tiny balls. And it was a very incredible experience because, I mean, it's an abstract idea, really. We know he said more than those lines. But, you know, to actually hold in my hand this little pile of all the words that Jesus had said in Scripture. So I wanted to do something with them, and I decided to enshrine them into a shroud, thinking about the Shroud of Turin, of course. And so between two layers of silk, I hand-stitched around each little pearl. There are 1,010. This is a close-up view. And the way that it ended up is they're kind of centralized and they sort of burst out from this cosmic center. This is one of the pieces that's also in the exhibit at the Aldrich. I'm going to move into the memory spaces. This is a piece called Oh, the Night of the Weeping Children, and is a book that I created after taking a course with Harry Reese in College of Creative Studies in book arts. And this is a piece that I see as the seed piece for all of the works that center on the Shoah. I was very moved by this poem, and so I created a small book, and I held on to this book for a couple of years, and then finally did this next piece called Space for Memory. It was created in 1996 and was the first of three Shoah spaces I have created on the UCSB campus during Holocaust Remembrance Week. This installation was created in Gallery 1434, some of you know where that is, as a space where the visitor could come to sit in silence and reflect on the many emotions that were evoked during the week's events. In the dimly lit room, three of the four walls were covered with 144 burning memorial candles, and the candles were very evenly spaced and resting on thin metal shelves. Then they were interspersed with six large votive lights that represented the 6 million Jews murdered in the Shoah. A seventh candle served as a symbol of hope. Within the room was an inner sanctuary space defined by sheer gauzy hanging scrims. And then inside was a bench for the visitor to sit and reflect. And one could easily move from the inner to the outer areas. On Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, Rabbi Cohen led a ritual reading of David Rosky's Midrash Night Words, in which over 50 people participated. This ritual both activated and completed the space through a communal act of remembering. Another aspect of the space, one that was particularly important to me as an artist, was the fact that I was able to bring a ritual space into the art institutional setting. And it was the closest I had ever come to merging religious space with art space finally merging my twin interests of religion and art. So I see this as a very important piece for me. 2 years later, I created Memory of Children, which was the second show of space. This was created in the former Sedgwick Collection Room of the University Art Museum while it was closed for renovation. The space specifically commemorated the children who were victimized and murdered during the Shoah. The space was very dark since the walls had already been painted black for another installation. And along the walls, I randomly attached images of children's faces and placed a memorial candle beneath each one. The space was perhaps more poignant than the previous one for two reasons. It personalized the destruction by showing actual faces of many victims, and it also had a very fleeting and temporal aspect since it was only in place for the one day. Again, it served as the space for the ritual reading of night words. So from this second installation, a series of works evolved. I shifted into personal and domestic objects, things that could be individualized at the same time they could extend to represent the vulnerability and the memories of all individuals who have been victimized or oppressed. While these next forms are inspired from the Shoah, they are not only about the Shoah. I wanted to create highly personal symbols that could convey the vulnerability of the individual and at the same time rise above the morbid to offer a symbol of hope. I chose clothing for many of the objects because of the power clothing has to represent the person. This piece is just straightforward in its title. It's titled Dress, and it was completed in 1999, and it hangs extended from the wall. It is like a book in that it tells in these fading pictures and fragmented bits of text that are on the dress. It tells the story of a child's loss and abandonment. In this piece titled Boy, it places the baby's shoes on a metal shelf, and from the shoestring ribbons hang baby bird wings, suggesting a transcendence. In Ascension, this is the work in which the little girl's gloves are veiled in an outer glove of silk organza with trace images at the bottom of the veil that hangs down are trace images of the tops of trees. And then across the palms of the gloves, the text reads, "I was given a new name." And when I'm making the clothing forms, I'm really trying to maintain a communion with the individuals because my intention is really to invest their experience into the objects, to weave their voice directly into the forms so that they become materialized forms of their memories. Scroll of Children's Faces is a silk scroll that's been rolled and contained inside of a glass vitrine, offering a kind of portability to the form to carry the memory from place to place. To Gather is a silk, sheer silk bag that's covered in children's faces, and the butterfly wings are contained at the bottom. It's hung very high on the wall, kind of levitating out from the wall. 23 Souls places a cluster of partially burned candles, each standing in for a person. In this work, I wanted the sense of delayed memory that follows a victim long after they return to their ordered life and then maybe are caught off guard, as memory is often triggered when one looks at something that's completely unrelated. Memory Distance is a series of burned and scarred jars paired with a framed image, and the images contained inside the jars represent restriction and the location in which the individual was perhaps held beyond their will. then the framed works represent a space of transcendence through the window of memory as desire for a place of return or restoration of what was lost. Memory Indwelling is the third show of space that I created. This time I created it in collaboration with Richard Hecht, and it was installed on the UCSB campus just last week during Holocaust Memorial Week. The space was unique from the previous two in that it was created in a very unlikely alternative location, a non-art institutional space. We found the racquetball court at the faculty club, and the space was an amazing discovery because it lent itself perfectly as a very ominous location, reminiscent of a place where Jews could have been contained in the camps. It had a small door. I'll show you that door. You had this door, it was about, you know, shoulder height. You had to bend over to get into it. And then once inside, the walls were 20 feet high, very scarred and rough from use. And the ceiling was open to the sky, except that it was covered by chain link. So the enclosure was confining, but not without a sense of hope, since it provided an opening to the sky. You could have that sense of freedom if you looked upward. And then again on Yom HaShoah at noon, Rabbi Cohen led a group in the ritual reading of night words. In this space, we chose to emphasize memory by collecting fragments from the personal stories of anonymous individuals who experienced the Shoah. These were paired with images from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum photographic archive. We created essentially 60 paper faces. I would call them paper faces because we placed them at different heights around the room. We wanted them to represent the different heights of individuals. The image was placed directly on the wall, and then we imagined that the image was placed where the eyes of the individual would be. And then with tracing paper, we veiled each image like memory veils events with time. And on the paper, where the person's mouth might be, is where we wrote the personal account of their experience. So what this did was it positioned the memory where the mouth was, giving the person a voice. Now, the power of the space came in a way that we had not expected. The voice of the individual was symbolically activated by the wind as it moved in the space, as it lifted the papers, a few at a time, then more and more, so that at moments the entire room was alive with this fluttering paper voice sound. It was amazing. And it seemed as if these papers were sending hope upward into the sky. Here they are. You know, it was just, it was a very unexpected element. And then you see the chain link shadow as it's cast on the wall. I was sitting alone in the space on the second day. It was only up for a day and a half. And I was really able to grasp a bit about memory's power to heal, that while memory around the Shoah brings to mind past tragedies and horrific events, it also releases something. And while the event is never eradicated, the individual is able to experience fleeting moments of healing through remembering. I mean, memory is only a partial element that needs to be remembered again and again, and which is at the heart of ritual, which is the thing that people do in order to bring the memory to them again. And we had the ritual. You can see where the people had been sitting. We didn't photograph the ritual, but afterwards, some of the people reading the different texts. So these Shoah spaces are about connection, the connection between people's individual memories into collective memory when they are joined with the memories of others through the space, and particularly through the ritualization of the space. Which moves me into the final section of my work, materialized memory, or objects that are taken from the narratives of the various stories, events, and lives of individuals who inspire my work. I also see these next material forms as my way of more directly participating in what the Catholic Church calls the communion of saints, which is the tradition that extends the relationship between individuals beyond the separation of death. This is a book that I created in 1994 called Litany of Women. The work began from a discussion centered around the number of women mentioned in the Bible. Now, as an artist, I'm making visual objects from my research, and maybe in the way that many of you are writing, putting words together from your research. And so I wanted to see a visual form of what it looked like to see the women's names from the Bible. I mean, I could have gone and gotten a research book. There are several in the library that list all the women in the Bible. But instead, I took this straightforward manner, and I begin to cut out every woman's name where it first appeared in the text. And then I glued each of these onto a small square of silk, and I stacked them in order and encased them in a cloth pound box. Then the silks were interspersed with text fragments from the poetry of Jory Graham, who's one of my favorite poets. And these texts were chosen to suggest the longing that accompanies the unfinished stories of the women who are, for the most part, included in the Bible as secondary characters in the stories about men. I saw the box as a reliquary to save the memory of these women outside of the patriarchal system that has diminished their contribution. So I placed all of these in this box, and they're held together. You see, the first one is Eve, going all the way through to the end of the New Testament. As a Catholic woman, I experience a great deal of tension in my religious practice, but I am not willing to abandon Catholicism. So I make art as a means to work out many of my frustrations with certain aspects of the institutional church. Though the church is not the venue to show the work, which is interesting. I mean, my work is entirely about religion. It's entirely inspired by religion and by my experience as a Catholic. But all of my work is created for the art audience. Except I did want to include one piece. This is the cover of the lectionary, which is the ritual book used in the Roman Catholic liturgy. And it's one way in which my art has been utilized by the church. It's very different than the other works I've shown you, and many would call it an illustration project. But nonetheless, it's one way where I've been able to bring what I know about art to religion, as opposed to my other forms where I'm bringing what I know about religion to art. So in all of this, I am also very much a Catholic. This is a piece, Menstrual Liturgical Cycle, and is an ongoing work that started in 1994, in which I've been tracking my menstrual cycle through the liturgical calendar by making blood blots on pieces of silk. Each silk, you see, this would not be shown in the church. This could be. But each silk is then marked with text that links the day of my cycle, my body, to the particular saint honored that coincides on the ritual calendar. This piece was begun in response to the church's opposition to the ordination of women when Pope John Paul issued his letter on ordination in 1994. The central reason for this opposition was the specific physical difference of the female body from the male body, or Jesus' body. I thought the most direct way to emphasize this would be to make menstrual blood drawings from the center of this physical difference. I wanted to refer to the significance that menstrual blood held in the Middle Ages, when menstrual bleeding was associated with the bleeding of Christ. His body bled food and gave birth to new life. And as Bell Hooks writes in her essay, In the Radiance of Red Blood Works, the young girl's blood, like that of Christ, is a sign of transition. She becomes fully female through the act of bleeding, and it is this blood, not the absence of a penis, that most dramatically marks her difference from the male. So I began this piece really as a protest piece, but because I've been doing it now since 1994, it's grown, and this is a close-up. You can see that I'll mark the date that's taken from the ordo or the liturgical year. I'll mark that at the bottom. What happened, though, is it began to evolve and take on greater implications, since it has to be viewed within the context of Christian history and ritual. The work has expanded in its sacrality and is also, in my mind now, about the connection that time and memory make between the living and the dead, bringing the dead into the present by joining the two cycles, enabling me to participate bodily in a communion of saints. So my blood becomes a symbol for all women and their exclusion from the history. This piece, Menstrual Liturgical Cycle, is currently also included in the exhibit at the Aldrich Museum. This piece is Anonymous Saints. I have just a few more to show you. It's almost over. This piece is called Anonymous Saints, and it refers to those individuals who will never be canonized. And it's a series of genderless garment forms that are stitched along the bottom edge to also create these hanging bags. And then there's an obscured image on the front. It's a landscape location, and it's placed on the front of the garment, and it suggests the location where the spirit of this person transcended their earthly life. And then inside each form is an object that accompanies the individual on their journey. For instance, at the inside of this bag, there is a silk glove that I've sewn that is covered on the surface of the glove. It's covered with birds in flight. Now, I don't know who these individuals are. They're not assigned to anybody. They're anonymous to me, too. But I've created several of these forms, and I'm very interested in this idea of the anonymous saint. I've also created a series of gloves that stand in for the hands of individuals, the individual who holds an offering, standing underneath the symbol of flight, which is always a symbol of transcendence, at breaking through the ceiling to freedom. In this case, the glove transferred onto the surface is the destination of this unknown location that's been overlaid onto the map of Jerusalem, conflating these two places, bringing the city to Jerusalem. This is a series called Domestic Mary. I became very fascinated with Mary. And these are jars that are a series of reliquaries that hold this curious combination of domestic and religious objects from various sources. This one in the lower left has a book inside of it. I'll show you a little more up close. The rose, you see the statue of Mary inside of the jar with the apple on the far right. And they're all canned, like a cold pack canning method, like our grandmothers did, so that they're preserved. And I use liquids like oil that have, you know, symbolic meaning, oil, water, wine, no bodily fluids. So they're very luminous, and they're very eccentric, I think, for me. This is a piece called The Annunciation. I'll show you a piece up close. And I created this garment form that hangs like a belly, and inside of the belly of Mary is the Word, referring to the Word made flesh. This is titled Mary's Hands. There was an article in Life magazine a few years ago talking about just the power that Mary holds in contemporary culture and how very little is attributed to her in Scripture, and yet her devotions are widespread. And it, again, I like with Litany of Women, where I cut out all the names, I wanted to see what it looked like, what all the words in Scripture look like. So I did a carbon drawing in which I traced every word that's attributed to Mary in the New Testament. And this is the entire amount. So there really are not very many words attributed to her. And this is the final piece. Since I began with the handwriting of Emily Dickinson, I wanted to end with the handwriting of the 16th century Spanish mystic and reformer of the church, Saint Teresa of Avila. This is a project that I'm currently working on. I've been tracing her handwriting wherever I can find examples of her handwriting, reproductions. I trace that and make drawings. And in this particular one, I've layered three pages of her handwriting, one on top of the other. And I see these as relics. I mean, there's a whole devotion around the relics that still exist of Teresa of Avila, and I'm very interested in her handwriting as a relic, her mark that she left. Being an artist, that's very important to me. And when I trace my hand over her hand, it's a way of reverencing her mark, and it's a way of activating the relic. I think of these as twice-removed relics that are activated by my tracing. And I wanted to conclude with this piece because I also, in Art Studio, printed a print of this image that I brought tonight to give to all of you, so you can leave with a print. So it was printed by the photopolymer plate method and then printed on the letterpress, and I have a little stack of them over there, so I'll give you those. But in conclusion, I have presented works that have extended over almost a decade, and I see them as being categorized in three areas: the book, the altered Bibles, the memory spaces in which the book extends into space, and materialized memory, or the ordinary domestic objects that touch upon the narratives of those individual lives who inspire my work. On one level, my work is very Catholic and very particularistic to the Catholic tradition, while also being highly engaged with Judaism. By investigating issues around the body and memory in relationship to space and to the body, as well as the ritual component that is factored into the creation of art, in these ways, my work transcends any particular religion. But I would say that most importantly, what I am articulating in my work is that religion is an essential human experience. Thank you.